Good evening. Welcome to Eye to the Sky, the UFO synopsis here on the Paranormal Radio Network. I'm your host, DeAndrew. This is our 10th show, and I would like everyone for tuning in and making all this work. As a special thanks for Kira Mortensen for all her hard work and research for me, and to Joe Montaldo, our producer and owner of Paranormal Radio Network, and my wonderful media director, David Andrew. He's done a lot of work on the websites and everything and making everything come together. And tonight, our guest is Rob Simone, author, lecturer, and radio show host. He has worked for CAUSE, the Citizens Against UFO Secrecy, is the founder of AIR, the Association of Independent Researchers, and is executive director of Universal Sound and Light Productions. He has hosted radio shows in Australia, Nepal, and currently in London, England. He has authored several books and is a contributing writer to Fate Magazine. Rob was also recently listed in Fate Magazine's list of top 10 ufologists. Top 100 ufologists, I was just corrected. And thank you, Rob, for joining us tonight.
Hey, Dee, how are you? It's great to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, I've been waiting for this for quite a while. Your interests are as varied as my own.
Well, that's great to hear. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff out there, a lot of things to pique the imagination.
Yes, this is true, but tonight we'd like to kind of keep on the UFO topic if we can. That's all right with you.
Well, yeah, we'll take a stab at it.
Okay, well, there's other things that can connect into it, you know, like the ancient history and stuff. I've heard a lot about your book, the title can't come to my head right off the top.
UFOs in the headlines?
Yes. I've been kind of looking at the different things from it, and it is amazing.
Thanks. It is. It's the new book. It's over 300 pages. It's like a coffee table book. It's a kind of a big picture scrapbook, and it has all of the interesting news articles about UFOs going back from 1950 onwards. And they're all readable. They're an actual photograph of the article in most cases. And the first 150 really have not seen the light of day since they were published. They were discovered in a locker box in England, and they run consistently. They're all in chronological order from 1950s to 1954, and that really was the golden age of ufology. We have incredible reports contained in these newspaper articles that if they happened today, they would set the world on their head. Absolutely extraordinary stuff.
I was in several bookstores today looking for it, and unfortunately I didn't find it.
Well, you can find it online. It's at my website. If you go to robsimone.com, you'll find it there, and it's on Amazon.
Well, I was in hopes of finding it, so I'd have it handy right here in front of me, and unfortunately wasn't able to. But like I said, I've been doing some perusing online of the different things that's in it, and I think it would be worth the time to sit down and go through it page by page and read every word.
Well, it's one of those things that you can't get through, you know, in a week or probably even a month. It's something that you can almost pick up anywhere and start reading, or you can go through it and take yourself into the world of that time and read it as these things came out and marvel at the incredible stuff that's in there. There are reports in there that are absolutely stunning. I don't know what it was, but you see, the first 150 were all newspapers from England. And that's significant because in America, the Cold War mentality, this sort of cover-up machine, went into place in 1947, ostensibly. And after the crash at Roswell, there was the first round, the first sort of media cycle, which was open and honest. It reflected the sort of genuine nature of the media at that time. It said saucer crashed in Roswell. U.S. Army finds saucer. All the reports came out. And then, before you know it, the mentality took over, and it went underground, and it's been there for 60 years. But England didn't have a Roswell event. So their media was much more open, and they didn't have this sort of paradigm-shifting crash into their soil like we did. So the stuff that came out of their newspapers was absolutely stunning, and a lot of it had to do with things in America. Had covered the reprinted articles from the New York Times. There's articles in there about the Operation Mainbrace, about the U.S. Air Force admitting that there are UFOs over atomic energy installations, the 1952 flap. Arthur C. Clarke talks about UFOs. The Duke of Edinburgh was talking about UFOs. It's a whole range of things, from personal accounts, from things having to do with the war, from the RAF, Air Force, and much more.
Oh, cool.
Mm-hmm. Also some stuff from different countries, too. There's headlines that I brought back, newspaper articles I actually brought back from Turkey when I was there during the famous UFO dogfight incident. I have stuff from Asia, from France. So you get a bit of everything in there.
You were in Turkey during the dogfight?
Well, that's the funny thing. I mean, I was working for CARS, as you mentioned at the top of the hour, the Citizens Against UFO Secrecy, this civil activist organization. We sued the government for UFO information. And I did that in the late 90s out in Sedona with Peter Gersten, the UFO lawyer. And I was the paranormal paralegal. And we covered a lot of ground. We got a lot of information released. And it was an exciting time. But after that, I traveled around the world for 3 years exploring this phenomenon in different countries. And I ended up in Turkey in 2001, which was right before 9/11, coincidentally. And I was there walking around the famous Blue Mosque, which is the largest, one of the largest mosques in all of the Middle East and in Asia. And I was just having a look, and there was a guy that came up to me. I started talking with him. I asked him, just out of the blue, if there were any UFOs over Turkey, because he had a good sense of English, and he seemed like a hip kind of guy, and it was just kind of a gut instinct, and he said, wait here, and he walked away, and I thought maybe he was going to, you know, alert the authorities and, you know, have me thrown into a Turkish jail. I didn't know what was going on, but he came back with a newspaper in his hand, and it said UFOs over Turkey, bold national newspaper, and it turns out the day before, a Turkish Air Force pilot on a routine training mission, flying a T-37, American-made fighter jet, had this extraordinary account, this amazing, encounter with this UFO, and along with two other pilots in his squadron. He somehow talked about it. You know, he somehow managed to this made its way to the newspapers, which in of itself is a bit of a feat. And this story ran in the newspapers for a week. I actually got on the phone with the Air Force representative, the spokesperson, and we went back and forth, and he said, no, it's weather balloons, it was a flock of birds, it was a meteorite, and I actually spent some time there and sort of refuted some of the evidence, and it's actually one of the things that's in the book, as along with the story that goes with it.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. But most of the book is all journalism. There's no editorializing. There's no speculation. It's 100% newspaper articles. So it's for anybody. I mean, you can give it to anybody, you know, and just say, well, here's an interesting book. It's journalism, but, you know, it's ufology just through a purely journalistic perspective. So it's safe in some ways. It's not talking about stories. It's not trying to convince people with, statistics. It's just 100%. Let's just take a look at what, you know, people believe the newspapers, so let's have a look at the newspapers. And believe me, the stuff that's in there, they won't believe.
This is true. speaking of looking at this from a journalist point of view,
yeah.
Okay? Now, I have to credit my husband with this question.
Okay.
This is something both of us have been bantering back and forth for the last week. And he was kind enough to write it out for me, so I didn't have to have all this information off the top of my head. Okay, here we go.
Yeah.
Some of the latest public opinion polls being taken among ufologists indicate that is, excuse me, talked about by many ufologists indicate that as many as 70% of the people in America now think that the UFO topic is real and genuine. Surprisingly, just as many of these people think the government knows something about the topic and keeping what they know secret. I think it's fair to say that people who are still skeptical of the topic are now in the minority in this country. This being the case, you would think mainstream media would cater to popular public opinion, but they don't, especially on the local or network news broadcast. UFO reports that do make it into the news broadcast are still reported with giggles and verbal jabs towards the story. Usually, the laugh factor is purposely thrown in, or some stupid comment about, here's another one for the foil hat crowd, is added to the story. Now, you, as a journalist, have been, and you, having been a journalist for so long, why do you think this is still the case with mainstream media outlets? Do they report on this topic with the laugh factor thrown in by choice, or do you think they are being forced to handle the topic this way?
Yeah, and it's true. You'll see a report, say, in the local news, and they'll have that little sarcastic sort of lilt in their voice when they preface the story. Or they'll go out and they'll report on it, but, and maybe just throw in some references, some easy references. But you got to remember, the journalists themselves don't have the background in ufology that we do. They don't have the depth of understanding and the scope of ufology. They're probably not familiar with what the astronauts have said about it, what the former presidents have said about it, what the Russian generals and other countries, their governments have said about it. They don't get the gravity of it. So to them, they only have the experience of what they have seen through common culture, and common culture celebrates it for its entertainment value. And yes, there have been some interesting shows on the History Channel and other ones that have dealt with it seriously, that do cater to people's genuine interest in it. So by and large, you have a kind of a mixed bag. But it's not always the case. I have to say, Fox News affiliate in Hawaii, in Honolulu, recently did a story about a UFO sighting that was captured by their own cameras. I think it might have been one of their traffic cameras. But it was big, and it was incredible, and it was seen by people on the beach. They went down and interviewed the guy that saw it, and they didn't make light of it. When Jaime Maussan in Mexico reports on the stuff, there is no derision. There is no, you know, comedic aspect to it. He's been doing it for, you know, better part of, 15 years there. So, yes, you do, you know, out in the Midwest and, you know, in Michigan and these different places, sure, you're going to get the local folks, you know, doing their thing with it. But by and large, you're right. It has become commonly accepted. People do get a sense of it. But remember, it does take a bit of scratching before you, you know, break the surface of this. And you can't expect the folks that are just living their lives normally and don't investigate this to really get into it that much. But we've been surprised lately. The UFO Roswell Festival that happened over the summer, celebrating the 60th anniversary of the Roswell crash, generated some very serious reporting. One was the Washington Post, the Sunday edition, the most read edition of the Washington Post. This is the newspaper of record for Washington, D.C., and they wrote up, must have been at least 1,000 words, with pictures, references to ufology and disclosure, references to books like Dr. Roger Lear and Richard Dolan. It was an extraordinary expose, almost. And we've seen much more than that. So, yeah, there is the giggle factor. And when you're throwing in a piece at the end of the news, you're one of the local affiliates, that's what you do. It's a template these guys use. So, yeah, if you're talking about the local weather and traffic news, and yes, they have a very simple format. They're not forced to do it. They're following the herd. It's the breakout reporters, you know, that do this stuff, the journalists that actually can tackle their own issues. They're the ones that make a difference. And these networks that do these one-off documentaries, that's where you'll see a little more in-depth. But don't hold your breath, because, again, all these things follow the trends, and these are the trends of television. And the trends of television have requirements, very quick things, things that are people can get from all walks of life. It has to fit into a format. It has to be edited in a way that keeps people's attention. So the medium of television itself has demands which don't necessarily lend itself to any in-depth reporting on really anything.
Oh, but people who do consider the UFO topic valid are in the majority. But the way the story is still handled by the media, they're falsely made to believe their opinion is still in the minority. Have you started to see any trend in mainstream media mindset towards a higher, more honest, straightforward reporting on the topic?
Well, yeah, you know, when you talk about honest and straightforward reporting, we do see some of that. We see a lot of it on the radio. We see some of it on television. I think really the best truth out there is what you can find on the internet. That's going to be the real, that's really going to crack this egg wide open, and it's already beginning to do that. And we shouldn't, again, another way of looking at this is we shouldn't have to rely so much on this coming out in the news and be reporting. A lot of people, you know, they slam their fist and they pound the table because they want to see it treated better on television. They want to see this topic, you know, handled with more sincerity. But it is something that people come to in their own way. And I'm not sure if even a really great television show or a series of television shows would change people's opinion that much. It would open them up a little bit more, but true acceptance of this comes through your own personal pursuits. And I think only a small fraction of our personal pursuits really is dependent upon what we see on any media outlet. But I have to say, though, going back to my book, you know, on these news articles, things were happening all the time. And there was such an abundance of it being reported upon. That definitely had an impact, just because of the frequency of things. Now, things have calmed down quite a bit since the 50s. But during that time, people's imaginations were exploding. And I think we see everything we do today because of what happened during that time, the golden age. Because it was everywhere, and it was all over, and it really fueled people's imaginations. So we see the results. You know, we see Arthur C. Clarke writing his business. We see Steven Spielberg. We see all the great things, and the Hynek's of the world, and you know, the Jacques Vallée's of the world. They were in their infancy stage in 1950. So this definitely had a big impact on all these people.
You mentioned the Washington Post and how they covered the Roswell conference, and I had looked on the Washington Post online site for their coverage of this latest X conference, and on that page they had a video embedded in the page of, you know, what had went on during the press conference and whatnot. And the way they handled it really kind of bothered me. Again, they had the giggle factor in there.
Oh, you're talking about that one reporter who did a little live segment there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Well, you gotta remember, he's not a straight reporter. In other words, I think, wasn't his column sort of arts and entertainment?
Basically, yeah, it did.
It was like a lifestyle. He had like a lifestyle column. And that video part of it is just kind of an addendum to his regular reporting that's print. Sometimes they'll throw, now that they have a website, you know, these news agencies, newspapers, now they have a website, they need to create content for it. So if they're going out on a story and it looks like it'll be juicy, in other words, they'll have some visuals to it, they'll take it on a camera. They'll knock something together really quick. They'll throw it back, and they'll throw it up on the website. I don't think it's a large consequence, but was there something in particular about it that you didn't care for?
It's just the way he kind of, condescending way of talking, you know, the way he portrayed, you know, what was trying to be put forward. Also, he just kind of made it look like we were a bunch of old 50s era contactee movement, you know, they'd all go out to the rock and wait for the Space Brothers.
Yeah, yeah, there is that sort of lingering shadow that's cast over, you know, this whole field. And they did show that one picture of Bob Miles behind the podium where you can only see his eyes.
Yeah.
Sort of holding his forehead, that makes him look very strange. Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, they do put that in there because it's a way of covering himself, you know, covering the newspaper. If they go out and say, look, this is a lifestyle piece. You know, yeah, the way they look at it, we should be lucky that they came out at all. So the fact that they remembered a few names and got a couple facts in there, you know, for a newspaper like that, at this point in time, that's really the best you can hope for.
Getting into the television media, the progression that, using History Channel for an example, of depicting these cases and then turning around and debunking them, and then moving from that into UFO files, supporting the idea. What's your opinion of this kind of wishy-washy, you know, can't make up their minds mindset?
Say the question again.
Using History Channel for an example.
Okay,
when they first started out doing UFO documentaries, they were all geared towards debunking cases.
Okay.
Or just saying, you know, it's hallucinations or whatever.
Yeah.
Moving, you know, going from that to programs like the UFO Files.
Okay.
Having kind of a wishy-washy, can't make up our mind which side to portray type programming.
Yeah.
What's your opinion on that kind of a situation?
Yeah, well, yeah, I actually work with some of the producers who have made some shows for the History Channel, and I've talked to them myself about some shows, and they're wanting to put together some television shows that they were looking for a host, and so I've been in negotiations, and I've pitched them some shows about UFOs. So you got to remember that the History Channel has a certain appetite for creating, for accepting shows, making them, and the Discovery Channel also has an appetite. Now, many people know that the Learning Channel, the History Channel, Discovery Channel, National Geo, so many television stations, networks have been putting on shows related to this field. I mean, it's never been anything quite like it. Each one of them has their own particular appetites for what they want and how far they can go. You know, they have a base audience, and the base audience is middle America. It's the guy coming home. It's, you know, the kids, the older folks. It's the midsection of America is their base audience. So, yes, for that, they have been doing a pretty good job getting all of, you know, people like me and everyone else in the field getting us up on these programs and talking. I mean, that's really extraordinary in of itself. But you're right. Some shows, you know, they just make you grind your teeth. Some shows you think, wow, I'll be damned. They did good. You know, sometimes they tackle the 9/11 issue. That makes some people crazy. These UFO shows, yeah, it's hit or miss, you know. There's no particular agenda. Most of the time, the guys who greenlight these projects are 22-year-old executives who are looking at it from a standpoint of entertainment, of information. Does it fit into the overall theme of the network? So on and so forth. So there's a lot of other considerations in this thing long before they're worried about if they're too pro or too against. There is an inherent balancing that goes on, but that usually falls to the individual producers. These things usually are executive produced by the networks, and they do have a say. So, you know, it's always kind of a living project while it's being made. That's why you get a lot of different outcomes. It depends who's working on it. It depends how closely they were watching the production at the time. So it's more about the production process than it is, I think, any particular agenda.
Again, on that, we need to go to our bottom of the hour break. Good timing, Rob. We'll be back here in a few moments on Eye to the Sky with Rob Simone, and we'll pick up where we left off.
Great.
Welcome back to Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis. I'm your host, Dee Andrew, and tonight our guest is Rob Simone. Rob, we were talking about media and how it covered, its coverage of UFO reports and the like has been, shall we say, a little less than desirable.
Yeah.
And you had made a comment on the way History Channel and these other educational programming has been covering the UFO topic.
Uh-huh.
I was wondering if you're seeing more of a leaning towards the UFOs are real theory to, or more towards the debunking end, or is it kind of in the middle?
No, we're definitely leaning towards the UFOs represent some sort of an intelligent contact from an extraterrestrial race. Absolutely, for a variety of reasons. We have astronauts coming forward. We have advancements in technology in general. Everyone in Mexico has a video recorder, it seems. And now it only takes about 5 minutes from when they record something to when they put it on YouTube to when it goes around the world. So the advances in technology have been incredible, and that you can't stop. The witnesses are coming forward. The access to information is getting much, much easier. And so, yes, absolutely, we are seeing incredible things with more sophistication coming through on the networks and channels that devote any attention to it, I think in a way in which that we've never seen before. We've got so many shows now dedicated to this paranormal field in general, in one way, shape, or form. People are becoming very savvy. You know, they know about EMF meters for ghost hunting. You know, they know about abductions. They know about, you know, the things that probably weren't the case back 20 years ago.
I agree. The way even local news programs, like I live in the Phoenix area, and here this last summer we had a flare drop, and people were going nuts. The Phoenix lights are back. Well, sadly, it was a flare drop. But even then, the local news kind of played it up as being, you know, a tinfoil hat fringe, you know?
Yeah.
And a lot of that was played on YouTube. And on YouTube, there's been a lot of CGI and hoax videos. Some of them are blatantly, you know, fake.
Uh-huh.
And some of them are blatantly fake, but some researchers are just going nuts over them, saying, oh, these are the best we've ever seen. And kind of what's your opinion on these people who jump the gun without doing any real good investigating into the sources of these videos?
Well, I don't know too many people that are in a position to affect a lot of people's opinions that have made too much noise over a particular video that they thought was, you know, genuine. Anybody that's really in the field knows that you can't assert, you can't, you know, say for sure if there's a video that's real or not. Some of them have great characteristics. Some of them you can write off a little more easy than others. But if one looks genuine, and you resonate with it, that's great. But there are not many people that can say, well, that's definitely, you know, for real, because we weren't there. It's not the one piece of evidence or the one footage that really goes a long way to people. It's the mountain of evidence that that really convinces people. But you're right, there are these videos that come along and they make a big splash, like that Haiti video.
I was going to mention that one.
Yeah, that one was great because it was big and bold, and it looked to those with a discerning eye, they could kind of sense that it was manipulated, and it just didn't have that real quality. Although it's getting harder and harder to tell because they're really smart about it. They put in the right audio, they put in the right video, they know how to do it, and they make it look rough. But to those of us who've been out in the field, we get a good sense of what's really real and what's too good to be true. And that one was one of those things where people thought it was too good to be true, and it turns out it was just the fact that, this guy had some free time and made a video that generated millions of hits. He was a CGI programmer. He was doing it in his spare time.
And interesting enough, just yesterday I was going from YouTube to, was it LiveLeak and a few others, and I the same video listed as both being from Haiti and another one saying it was from Saudi Arabia.
Well, sure, because you get every guy, with a computer at and a dial-up, internet connection that can grab this thing and change it around. So, yeah, it gets kind of washed through, the cycle. And, you'll see it. You'll see it come up with wrong tags on it. And it's not perfect, but It is powerful nonetheless.
I'm finding a lot of interesting footage on the video link places. Have you noticed any of that bleeding over, so to speak, into researchers?
Into what bleeding over?
All these videos and whatnot that's coming out of like websites like LiveLeak and YouTube. Being taken seriously by many researchers?
Well, there's always been stuff floating around, and now it's just a little bit easier to see. But, some of it's useful for some reasons. Some particular researchers have niches, areas of interest that they pursue. If a UFO video happens to fall into it, then it might become useful. But largely people kind of look at it and there's entertainment value, obviously, but it's all valid to use for one thing or another, especially when it comes to looking at this phenomenon play out in our skies.
Change the subject here now. I think we've whipped that one about as much as we can. On your new book, Around the World and Beyond, is that covering vast array, how's that, of different subjects, or just
well, that,
one?
That hasn't been published yet. That's a manuscript, but I'm still shopping around for a publisher for that one.
Okay, do you have a publishing date on that one yet?
I don't. I'm shopping around, because that one's like kind of my life story. That's the story of my travels throughout the world, a three-year trip through the world where I was in the outback of Australia and the Aboriginals and meeting the Dalai Lama in the Middle East. So that one definitely requires, I think a very serious publisher. So I'm holding out for someone like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Susan, your travels around the world, have you observed a more open attitude toward UFOs in other countries?
That's it. That's exactly what I tell people, that, living in India for a while and talking with people, the Hindus and the Muslims, every Hindu you meet has no problem with the idea that we're not alone. They've already accepted it. Most Muslims have, too. A shockingly large majority of Muslims know about this stuff and will tell you stories about these kinds of things. All the Aboriginal peoples of the world understand that there are things up there that have to do with us down here. They don't have a need to prove it to anybody. They've already accepted it. It's only us here in the West that are still running around getting all freaked out about it and having to qualify and quantify this reality. Most of the world has already accepted it, and because of that, they are, in a sense, sort of more spiritually advanced in a way, insofar as they've already accepted what we are struggling to accept. So by doing so, they're a little further along, because it's something, once you become, you know, once this reality is accepted through you internally, and you've come to terms with it, then you're just able to grow beyond that. A lot of people are waiting for the government to say it's okay for them to believe. So there's a lot of people here in the West that are suffering from a sort of arrested spiritual development.
Well, why does the U.S. seem to be such a holdout on this? Is it because the U.S. might have the most to hide regarding knowledge of this?
Yeah, the U.S. is pretty... Yeah, they are pretty stingy in their information. So is the U.K. Russia has done some amazing things. France has done some very interesting things. But yeah, America really has held out for a long time, and partly because we're the ones, you know, the CIA wasn't always around. The NSA wasn't always around. These things came out of the Cold War. The compartmentalization that goes on in our government is extraordinary. Bill Moyers, the legendary Bill Moyers, who did The Power of Myth and did these other great shows for PBS, did a documentary about the secret government back in like the early 80s. He was a member of CFR, Council on Foreign Relations. He was one of those guys that was inside, and he said, wait a second. He woke up, and he started telling the world about this stuff. Now, that's extraordinary. He was one of the first, and if you go online, you can find it. Now, this reality, these programs are kept in a very dark place, so dark that the president can't even shine light on it. President Carter, you know, saw a UFO before he became president, reported it. He was in the company of about 20 or 30 other people, even wrote up a little report and submitted it to whatever agency was relevant at that time, back in the 70s. He became president. He was asked about it. He said, yeah, I saw it, and it was, you know, it was an extraordinary thing, and even tried to get information. Couldn't. He was refused. Bill Clinton tried to get information about UFOs. He was refused. The president's only there for 4 years. They're not around long enough to make it worthwhile of the people who really pull the strings to let him in on the real show. There's no reason to. So, yeah, there is a secret government. There's a way in which these things are classified that nobody on the inside, you know, there's no one that knows everything on the inside, except maybe Kissinger, you know. But it's just not part of how the structure works. The UK tends to follow suit. You know, we're kind of married. We're kind of joined at the hip with the UK. And yes, it does cause embarrassment. And yes, the last thing a government would do would want to say, well, there is this, you know, these craft that are intelligently controlled, and their technology is far superior to ours, and we can do nothing to alert you to them or to protect you from them. So, yeah, making an announcement like that, it goes against the very nature of what government is supposed to do. The police, there's not enough police in the world to police everybody, but the presence, the idea that you should stop at that stop sign has been ingrained in you, and therefore society works. But 9 times out of 10, they're not going to be a cop around when you go through a red light or when you break the law. But it's their presence that they have. It's the idea, it's the concept that everyone has been conditioned to believe that keeps law and order around when there is no law and order around.
With your work with CAUSE, what was your guys' success rate in getting information out of the government through Freedom of Information?
The Freedom of Information Acts were pretty good. That was upwards of 80%, I'd say. Some of the other things we did with CAUSE was trying to sue the government, which is a lot harder because the government is a sovereign entity. There was one case where we had a couple hearings in federal court in Phoenix, Arizona, where we got a hearing on a Freedom of Information request that came back that was not properly filled out, and there was some communication with the DOD that led us to believe that they did not take this request in earnest. They did not give it its due diligence. There's kind of an arbitrary level. There's kind of like it's not something that's enforceable, but there is a good faith, they call it, a good faith level of answering these requests. And we had some documentation that led us to be able to argue that they did not treat this with good faith. So that opened the door for a few hearings, and it ultimately did what we wanted it to do, which was bring publicity to this. Not to win a court against the government, because that would never work.
Gosh, I just had her name on the tip of my tongue, and just as I went to say it, the journalist who worked with Cause on the Kexford case.
Oh yeah, Kane.
Leslie Kane.
Yeah.
Yes. After Sci-Fi Channel did their program on the Kexford case,
uh-huh.
They didn't hear anything more about how Coalition for Freedom of Information.
Yeah, the Sci-Fi funded a bunch of lawyers to go after this particular case. And no, I have not heard anything. I've spoken with some of the execs at Sci-Fi, and there hasn't been anything that, any kind of movement on that they have, put together in any kind of form that would be presented to the public.
I think that's sad, terribly sad.
No, but it was great that they tried. But
it's sad that they didn't, say, okay, this is what we did, this is what happened. They just kind of, let it drop.
Yeah. The cover-up is really amazing. These files get lost, and it's like a movie script. What we've been dealing with this cover-up. People have been dying. People have been going into hiding. It's just been one thing after another. It's an extraordinary event that we're struggling with. It's something that the world is going to have to face up to. But people like us in the field are just a little ahead of the curve.
Yeah, there's a lot of people that are like me and waiting for the proverbial landing on the White House lawn.
Yeah.
So we can go, I told you so.
Right.
That would be my giggle factor.
Yeah.
On air, talk to us a little bit about your program, the Association of Independent Researchers.
Okay, sure. Well, I've been on the air in London for about 5 years now, and I've interviewed really all the people in ufology and the alternative information community. If people want more information, they can go to robsimone.com. That's R-O-B-S-I-M-O-N-E, robsimone.com. And there they can listen for free, and they can see who we've had on. And it occurred to me, I think after the first year of broadcasting, that there should be more than this two-hour platform I people on this FM station in London. We broadcast on 104.4, and of course, worldwide on the internet. I just felt as though we could craft this thing a little bit better, so I founded AIR. And what it does is it represents the particular research of independent scientists that are working in technologies that have to do with the types of things that we here in this community are familiar with, like free energy, like advanced propulsion technology, like the kind of research that goes far enough along the established route of academia, but yet doesn't get the serious attention because it simply doesn't fall into what is commonly accepted. So what I do is I take the person and I take their research. Of course, I bring them on the air, present them to the world, and I help them highlight and organize their information to submit to different bodies because most of the time these guys are looking for grants to continue their research. And it has been something that, we've been doing now for about 4.5 years. and it's open to anybody who is a researcher or a scientist who's having trouble getting their information represented in the media.
Oh, kudos.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Kudos. Good idea. Bless you for it. We need more organizations like that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you wouldn't believe. I mean, I know so many people that are teachers, and they get grants all the time. You know, if they want to do a study on this or they want to take a look at that. So some of the work, and there's a sort of a fine line, falls close enough into the established guidelines for these grants that I know that if it was organized properly, it could be successful. So that's what we've been doing for about 4 years, and I'm happy to say we've had some great success, and hopefully when we have more time and more funding, we'll be able to do more. If people, if they're interested, as I say, they can just go to robsimone.com, and it's right on the webpage there.
Well, keep up the good work. I'm very impressed.
Thanks.
It's a wonderful idea. Oh, excuse me. Oh, let's see. Fate magazine. and unfortunately, we got like about 2.5 minutes till we top the hour break.
Okay.
Listed you as one of the top 100 ufologists.
Yes.
How did that make you? Just a quick little blurb on how you felt when you were informed on that.
Well, it was great. It really was, because Fate magazine has been around for 60 years, more than 60 years. I think it's 64 years. I'm looking at the first issue, volume 1, number 1, Fate magazine, spring, 1948.
Oh, my.
25 cents. And on the cover is the first article is The Truth About Flying Saucers by Kenneth Arnold.
Oh, wow.
So here we have a magazine that is devoted to the strange and unknown, to true reports of the strange and unknown for all this length of time. And they have done more to get this stuff out to Middle America and they're in other countries too, than really just about any other magazine. So, yeah, for them to recognize myself and others in this field was really a great honor. And I've since have written a few articles for Fate magazine, and about crop circles and UFOs and NASA. Some of those are on the website, and others I put into my book, UFOs, Crop Circles, and the Mayan Calendar. It's a collection of articles, some of which come right out of the pages of Fate.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Speaking of Kenneth Arnold, I used to live not too far from Boise, Idaho for many, many years, and Kenneth Arnold was like an icon for me. And when he passed away, I was so upset and that I didn't, go out and look him up and talk to the guy.
Yeah, he was a legend. He was one of the first.
And then I had heard his daughter, and I can't remember her name because it was an unusual name, was thinking, toying with the idea of writing a book about him. Huh. And her family talked her out of it.
Hmm.
And if I could have found her, I would have told her, go ahead and do it. And
yeah.
On that note, we need to go to a break. We'll be back in a while. It'll be a fairly long one, so if you need to get something to drink or something to munch, here's your opportunity, folks. And we'll be back with Rob Simone here on Eye to the Sky on the Paranormal Radio Network. Welcome back to Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis. I'm your host, DeAndrew, and tonight we're talking with Rob Simone. Rob, I was sent a private message from one of our listeners in the virtual auditorium to ask you. It's from UK Addy, and this individual would like to know if you think anyone in the, or if you know if anyone in the British... wait, hang on. There's a lot of internet shorthand here. Does anyone think the British knows or have any information on alien technology?
Huh. Well, you know, I used to live in England, and I still do a radio show there, and that is something that, when it comes to that incident that happened in Rendlesham Forest, that makes me think that there could be something going on. But it wasn't until I started doing research for my new book, UFOs in the Headlines, that makes me think that there could definitely be some truth to that. And I wasn't aware of this stuff until I started putting these news articles together that back from 1952, Operation Mainbrace was the first really large joint NATO military exercise. It was conducted to let the Scandinavian countries know that NATO could mobilize a great force quickly if they needed to, if there was a Russian invasion, which was a kind of a looming threat at that time. So here comes Operation Mainbrace. Nothing that special, really. There are a lot of ships in the water, kind of an armada, some planes in the air. You know, just a full-on naval Air Force exercise. But what happened during it is extraordinary. It made headlines. You know, front page, you know, RAF sees, you know, UFOs on radar during Operation Mainbrace. And I just did a lecture at the X conference where I go into this with some video and some other things that demonstrates that what happened there during this exercise back in 52 parallels an event that happened in Turkey in 2002. What happened was that the pilot saw a meteor, a large meteor, racing across the sky, but right behind it he saw this silver disk, and the silver disk was keeping pace with this very large meteor that was hurtling towards Earth. And they couldn't figure out what that craft was and how come it was able to, you know, maintain station, as they say, with this meteor that, you know, is traveling at thousands of miles an hour. And the meteor didn't do any significant damage, which is interesting because it sounded like, by all reports, that it was a pretty large meteor. And we have these various reports from different pilots during this joint naval exercise that saw this thing and reported on it. The radar picked it up as well. And just clicked in my mind from a report that I was familiar with from Turkey, where the same thing was caught on video. And I had this video, I show it during my lectures, of a meteor crashing towards Earth, and this blinking UFO right in the trail behind it. It's unmistakable. It's one of the most extraordinary things you can ever see, because you have this natural event. You have this blinking UFO right with it, and it's one of these videos that, you know, this was back in 2002, that to me looks 100% genuine for a lot of reasons. But what was extraordinary is that this UFO was broken up, and it didn't do the damage that it would have if it was in one solid piece. It would have devastated the Earth. It was so big. I mean, these things were the size of Buicks. I mean, the chunks of these things were, let's update my references. It was the size of a Hummer, some of these rocks. But together, you know, it was the size of a small football stadium. And that would have had an absolutely devastating effect. So the thinking is that this UFO was breaking up this meteor so that it wouldn't cause this incredible damage to the Earth and the people. So it might have happened two times, both of the times coincidentally caught or noticed by humans. So, you know, we have that during Operation Mainbrace. We have other events that happened in the U.K., that the people were photographing these things. The army was running around chasing them. And I've got over, 150 articles in my new book, UFOs in the Headlines, that outline this stuff. So, yes, with the frequency that these things are reported on, it's absolutely possible that the UK, as well as the US, very might have their hands on some kind of information or some kind of hardware that originates from beyond our Earth.
just, well, discussing this made me think of this. Do you think there could be a possibility that the United States is sharing alien technology with the British Ministry of Defense, since we are such close allies?
Yeah, we really are. And it goes beyond the word ally. I mean, there are certain powers that still come from England. England has an incredible grip on the world, on Canada and other countries. Their force is felt beyond what we can noticeably see, you know, by our elected government. And so when it comes to sharing information about them, well, that comes down to the intelligence agencies. And that gets broken up into need to know, that gets broken up into different factions, that gets broken up into all kinds of different segments that are, some have oversight, some don't. So it gets broken up into this maze of networks that, yes, some of those, I'm sure, shares information with the UK and vice versa. But I think that they're so far down below the radar that it would be almost impossible for them, for these links, these networks, to be discovered.
I think that would be an interesting question to ask Nick Pope.
No, I've asked him about that. And he, you know, I just spent the weekend with him a few weeks ago at the X conference. He can't speak to that. He was the MOD sort of spokesperson for these kind of things. Beyond that, it's his speculation is based upon what everybody else knows in the field. And when it comes to that particular question, nobody knows.
That would be interesting to find out.
Well, yeah, I mean, if the only way we're going to find out is somebody comes forward and says, yeah, I happen to work in this project and I shared information with so-and-so. But even then, he'd come under great suspicion, and that wouldn't be enough, really, to call the issue, you know, outed. It wouldn't be enough to call the issue, 100% verified. So it would take quite a bit, and we'd have to go, you know, it's going to take quite a bit to get that particular question answered correctly.
What do you think it would take to get the United, because I think the United States is the holdout. If we can get the U.S. to come forward with the truth, the rest of the governments would. What do you think would it take to get the government to do so?
Well, that's the very thing that I talk about in this new documentary that just came out. It's called Fast Walkers. And have you seen it?
I have a copy. Yes.
Okay. Yeah, it's 96 minutes. It's all high definition. It's this one is really top of the line production. And that's one of the questions that I address in this documentary, is that yes, America has the overwhelming military might and power on this planet right now, so that they're the ones that are calling the shots, most likely. When it comes to covering up or not covering up, it very well might be that there might have been these arrangements or agreements made that nobody, you know, comes forward and releases this information, no government, before the U.S. says it's okay to do so.
And yet we have all these witnesses that Dr. Greer got together.
Well, you know, a lot of people have come forward, but no government has come forward officially.
This is true. You'd think that the government would be, like, shaking in their boots, so to speak, that these people are speaking out, but they obviously don't care.
Well, no. There was some great stuff that came out, but no, I doubt that. These guys got a lot of other very important things to worry about. A couple people coming forward in their eyes, not a big deal. But no, I don't think any government would come forward. You know, like Brazil.
Well, I wouldn't call 500, at least 500 people coming forward, just a couple.
Yeah. Well, whoever it was and whatever they said, it came and went. It made a big splash, but it wasn't enough to stop this machine of secrecy, certainly.
It was a good start.
So the point is that, yes, there has been no government disclosure, and it could very well be that the government of the United States it could be the reason for this not happening yet.
Yeah, I just think it's definitely wrong, and speaking of the X conference, we kind of touched on this during the first break. How did it go for you? Was it a
good conference? It was a great conference. It was 3 days. I spoke, of course, I gave some highlights about my new book. There were people from Dr. Canada, Dr. Sala, and some of the others that made up this field spoke. It was an incredible release of information. Really, really serious stuff went on at this conference, and it was an absolute it was an absolute delight.
There was a bit of controversy. Do you feel comfortable talking about that?
Yeah, at the very end, there was a guy who I haven't met before, who was a journalist who just said some things like about Haim Hassan. He was talking sort of very loosely about Jaime and suggesting that Jaime was loose and suggesting that other people had affiliations that were not 100% genuine. He spoke for about three or four minutes, and Jaime got upset and he wanted to leave, but he didn't. We just had to say, look, it's not so much this panel was not so much about kind of throwing mud at other people in the panel. It was really about letting people ask and answer questions. So once that statement was said, we got on with it. But Jaime got upset because he kind of threw some mud at Jaime, and Jaime, he's a very passionate man, and he was almost ready to leave, but he didn't. He stayed. So I'm really happy that we finally worked it out.
Oh, every presentation I've seen that Jaime Hassan is, I keep mispronouncing his last name, Mausan.
Yeah.
Has done that I've seen. I was very impressed with the collection of videos and works that he has done. And that was Richard Farley, by the way.
It was Richard Farley. And you know what?
Yeah.
It was about 7 o'clock, and the panel had already gone about an hour. And poor Richard, he was really tired, and it had been a long weekend for him. So he was just, his blood sugar was low, and he was tired, and he was just saying things he didn't really mean. So. In the end, it was just more about his, I think, his blood sugar than anything else.
And then after he gave his little talk and he went outside, and I guess he was ranting and raving to anybody who would listen to him outside.
Yeah, the poor guy, he just stayed up past his bedtime a little bit too much, unfortunately.
Okay. I love conferences. I really do.
Uh-huh.
I think they do have a purpose of sharing information.
Yeah.
But isn't it kind of like preaching to the choir?
Well, the people that do come out have usually come out to these things before. It's true. There are always attempts by the people who make these conferences to reach new people. It's true. And the people who do come and listen to these these lectures, I'm sure, have heard these types of things in the past. Absolutely, yeah. Now, it's not their intention to do so, but we can't predict who's going to turn up and who's not.
This is true.
Yeah.
It was just a bit of an observation that myself and several of my associates have made over the last few months. Mm-hmm.
Now, I will say that when these conferences are put on, they always have new stuff. I mean, my stuff is brand new. Nobody's seen my stuff ever. I didn't go through all the lectures, but everyone who speaks there always presents new material.
Oh, I agree.
I can't say that for Stanton Freeman. God bless him. But no, it's always new stuff. And my stuff was shocking even to me. So, yeah, these people have heard it, but they haven't heard. I haven't heard this new stuff. And not only that, there is a whole new level of technology that's being applied to these things, where they're being taped, the DVDs are getting out there, the distribution is getting out there, these things are streaming online, so that, it happens at the conference, but what happens there really resonates now more than ever throughout the world. You can go to YouTube and see the whole conference, you can go there and see everything, so it really reaches a lot more people than the few hundred that happen to be sitting there at the time. And for the people who do sit there, who do are lucky enough, they get to hang out. They get to hear all the, all the real information. They get to have, a great time. So it works either way. If you're there, it's great. If not, you can still get the stuff.
Well, I found out going to these conferences where you find Oh, a lot more information, detail by what goes on after the schedule of the events of the day are done and over with, and everybody's just kicked back and relaxing.
Dee, you are 100% correct. Everything I know, I think, comes from just talking to people. And largely, yeah, at these conferences, you get the real, real deal. So much so that it is my main source of information. You know, when I'm just talking to people and sharing people and what goes on when you're mingling around, it is an incredible opportunity to really find out what's going on. Absolutely. Couldn't agree with you more.
And you get to know the individual presenters a little more and their many talents. Which I won't embarrass you on that one.
No, it's okay. Hey, look.
Well, at the X conference that I went to, I believe it was either 2000, no, it was 2005, I think it was.
Yeah.
The conference before this last one.
Yeah.
And at Cynthia Siegel's room,
yes,
her little get-together she has every evening, Rich Dolan was getting ready to leave, and you reached in your pocket, pulled out a harmonica, and started playing. And Rich's face lit up. He reaches into his pocket and pulls out a harmonica. And the music you two were playing just blew me away, because I have to tell you, I'm not really a fan of harmonica music, but listening to you two was a joy. I'd never heard music like that coming from a harmonica before, let alone two.
Yeah. Yeah, thanks. I play a little. He plays a little more than I do, but I bring mine because he usually has his. And, yeah, we have fun. I mean, everyone who knows me knows that, you know, we have a ton of fun at these things. And it's always, you know, it's always an event. And I was a musician for 10 years before I got into ufology. I sang and played guitar, both solo and with bands up and down the East Coast. So, yeah, you know, being in that business so long, you can't help but to break out the old axe once in a while. And funny enough, you know, speaking of that, Bruce McAbee, one of the speakers at the last X conference, he plays piano, and he actually played for the whole crowd during the banquet with his son for about 3 or 4 hours. So, yeah.
He got it the one that I attended.
Yeah, it was, yeah, he's a great guy. So, yeah, I mean, it's always a lot of fun. So, these events that happen are extra special, for sure.
The next one we go to, I'm going to have to tell my husband to make sure he brings his guitar.
Yeah, yeah. We'll break out a guitar and we'll just start singing. I remember being one with Dr. Len Horowitz, and we were kicking around till 3 in the morning. And, look, you know, the crowd that comes out for these are just great people. So it's aside from being an incredible learning experience, it's just a great time.
And at the X conference I attended, and once again, I met this individual up in Cynthia's room, who was a witness to the 2002 July UFO flyover Washington, D.C.
Right. His name is Will.
Yeah, and he gave me copies of the newspaper articles about the incident, and
yeah.
I was impressed with his recollection of what happened and the detail that he did. And
yeah.
Again, if you don't mix and mingle after the presentations and all the scheduled events are done at the end of the day, you miss out on a lot.
It's true. Yep. And well, the next big one is the Laughlin conference. I'll be speaking there doing a special.
Isn't the crash retrieval in November 1st?
Oh, yeah, that's right. And then Laughlin, that's true. They're the two next ones. Of course, it's something that you have to pick and choose. You know, you can't go to all of them. But I think definitely these ones that happen, these big ones that happen, are definitely worth checking out, because, as you say, you know, you don't get the experience of just watching a DVD as you do if you're there.
This is true. This is true. Let's see, we've got 2 minutes left. Or excuse me, 1 minute left, I was just told. Are you giving a presentation at the Laughlin conference?
Yeah, I am. We're doing a special segment this year that's, and I don't know how much I can say at the moment, but it's never been done before, and I'm going to be a part of it, and I can't say right now who else is going to be part of it, because we haven't got any confirmation, but it's a new segment. It's not a lecture. We think it's something that it's going to add some real excitement to the conference. And I'm talking with the organizers right now and help putting it together. And of course, aside from that, yeah, there'll be the usual assortment of the latest and greatest people. I always have updates on my website. Still there?
Yeah.
Okay. If people want more information about any of these upcoming events, they can. I'm on my website at robsimone.com under the upcoming appearances tab.
Oh, fantastic. We're planning on making the Laughlin Conference ourselves and hope to see you there. On that note, we need to go to another break. We'll be back in a few moments with Rob Simone here on Eye to the Sky on the Paranormal Radio Network. And welcome back to Eye to the Sky, the UFO synopsis here on the Paranormal Radio Network. And tonight we're talking with Rob Simone. Rob, I know you've done a lot of research into ufology. Have you done any on, like, the Hopi or any other Native American people's stories of the sky people?
Well, yeah, a bit. I've done some research that has led me into these areas. Of course, I've lived in the outback with the Aboriginals of Australia, and I lecture on that specifically, on their star people references and their abduction encounters, both modern day and in dream time. But yeah, there has been incredible comparisons made from different tribes, different nations. In the Americas from their experiences that go back from the earliest part of their history. The commonality between them is extraordinary. I mean, we're talking about star people, references from star visitors coming down, sharing information, sharing knowledge, and some of them, giving prophetic messages, and some of them, altering the course of their evolution. And there has been an acceptance of this general motif among the Native Americans that to anybody who's researching this in a reasonable manner has to quickly conclude that there is more than comparative mythology going on here, that these experiences reflect a genuine form of contact that take the place as best described by people of visitation of actual folks coming from the heavens. So yeah, there has been there's a lot of this that you have to kind of dive in deep. It's not something that you'll find on the surface, but if you go out to the reservations, I was fortunate enough to live in the Southwest for a long time. I'm in Los Angeles now, so I'm still in the area. But yeah, if you go out there, if you spend the time, I've done a lot of sweat lodges, which is a great opportunity to spend a lot of time with some of these elders, with some of the shaman, and you will discover that this is something that has touched many people, many Native people of this land. And it's a shame that it hasn't come out more. But as I say, I do talk about the Aboriginals of Australia and have incredible artwork and images from their historical presence of ufology. They have an incredible record of it that's a lot more visual than most other nations. So I tend to focus on that more than any other.
Last week I had Farah Yudozu on, and she was saying how she was giving a lecture on the star people in Turkish legend, and she was telling me that two Navajo ladies came up to her and said, no, that's our legend.
Huh, yeah. Yeah, you see that a lot. You really do.
And then you bring in the India legends of the Vimanas and all. There has to be something to this.
You know, that's what I tell people. You know, when I give these lectures, that you see the same type of references, the same type of artwork, even the same iconic images of these star people represented in civilizations separated by thousands of miles and thousands of years.
I agree.
Yeah. So the only reasonable conclusion is that, yes, there has been a visitation. And a lot of people say, well, how come Sumeria, how come ancient Egypt, or the civilization that made Machu Picchu, or some of these other incredible temples in Bali and Cambodia, why do we see more evidence of this visitation than we do, say, now? And I've come up with a theory, and I think it has to do with the truth on the ground. In other words, if you're open to this larger universe, you'll have a completely different experience than someone, say, living right next to you will have, if they're closed-minded. If you take one step towards this larger universe, it'll take two steps towards you. And imagine a civilization that's open to the idea of star visitation. Perhaps it's something that was written into their record. Very possible that ancient Egypt, they had no problem. They had no mental barriers to deter them from understanding and contacting this reality. So as a result of the whole collective mindset being open to this phenomenon, they were able to have extraordinary visitation encounters. Some people say, well, Mexico is experiencing incredible amount of sightings. And I would say, well, you know, I've been to Mexico. I was there in the late 70s. I was an exchange student. You know, I tend to have a pretty good understanding of the Mexican people. They're really open-minded. They're really smart. They understand what's going on. And they're way open, man. So it's not surprising that they're having incredible encounters, because it could be a reflection of their collective open mindset.
Well, that's true. And then a lot of the people there are descendants from the Aztec and the Mayan people, and they keep alive the traditional stories.
Could be part of it, too.
So I think that's part of the reason. Also, with China, they're very open.
Yeah, that's true. They're extremely interested. Japan, same way. They're incredibly interested in this field.
Oh, well, what surprised me was the communist Chinese government is okay with UFO groups.
Not only that, but there have been conferences in Shanghai, Beijing, and the Hunan provinces that have had attendance in the hundreds of thousands.
Oh, my.
Yeah. And I've done some work with CCTV and Nippon Television. They have an incredible thirst for this stuff. It's a reflection also of their mindset, too. They also, you know, you got to remember, you know, if you're in China or you're in Japan, you're also, you know, going to have the kind of media that, you know, the kind of superficial media that we have here. But there is, you know, there is a curiosity that's there for people who have the ability to get into it. We have a luxury here in America. We don't have to work, you know, 20 hours a day, most of us. And with free time comes our ability to let our minds wander and pursue things that don't necessarily have to do with keeping food, you know, in our bellies. So with these affluent countries, with these countries that are prosperous, they're the ones, I think, that can afford more time towards publishing, towards lectures, towards pursuing this, creating content, creating television shows. And so, yeah, it's no wonder that that China is catching up with Japan and America as far as creating content for this stuff. because once they get more and more affluent and their infrastructure starts to solidify, I think China is going to be, could be, the first disclosure country.
That would be an interesting twist of events.
It would be. It would be. But I've heard rumors, and I know some of the Chinese ufologists and researchers out there, and there's incredible stuff going on, but it's just it's a condition of their current sort of socio-economic reality that does not allow these kind of things to come out so freely when it comes to organizing, when it comes to, you know, really getting the stuff in a position where they can mobilize some serious, you know, tools, activist tools. But I think it's only a matter of time.
Just sitting here wondering why we don't hear here in the States, especially among the ufology circles, why we don't hear reports out of China.
Well, they're there, and I do go through them. I do have people that can translate Chinese for me, and I do know some of these sites, and I've seen the reports, and yeah, they happen just as they do here, believe it or not, with little difference in frequency or anything else.
Is there a lot of photographic evidence that comes out of China?
Absolutely, there's plenty of it. Yeah, I've got incredible video that I've gotten through some of my contacts, and when I lecture at some of these things, I often show it. It's astonishing. Yeah, absolutely astonishing what comes out in China, and I kind of like it because, you know, they over there, I don't know, there's a kind of believability that comes with some of these videos that you don't get in other ones. So I kind of like some of the stuff that comes out because to me it has a, some of the stuff that I've seen has a real genuine sort of ring to it.
Oh, well, now a lot of people don't realize that the Chinese civilization is, what, like 6,000 years old?
Yeah.
And a lot of their ancient mythology coincides with that of ancient Sumeria.
There are some crossover there, for sure.
A lot. one thing that I've been meaning to ask you, and I've been kind of holding off, what is the most interesting case or incident that you've delved into?
Wow, there's so many. And, you know, they're each unique in the sense that they all have their particular features. You know, some of them happen in different countries. You know, some of them happened to me, you know, when I was, you know, in Tibet or another interesting place. But just off the top of my head, there was, that's UFO related, you mean?
Yes.
Yeah, well, okay, you know, there
narrows it down a little.
Yeah, right, you could narrow the scope a little bit. Well, there was a very interesting thing that happened to me, and I wrote about this in Fate magazine, when I was trying to get to the bottom of this connection between NASA and UFOs and the connection between them. And that led me to a few interesting people that used to work for NASA back in during the Apollo days. Dr. Edgar Mitchell, the founder of the Noetic Institute of Science, he has been quite vocal about his opinions on ET life. He was on Apollo 14, and one of the, I think, the sixth man to walk on the moon, Dr. Edgar Mitchell, he's an extraordinary fellow. And I asked him flat out on my radio program, I said, you know, with your experience, what can you tell us from your context in the intelligence world? And he said that he had been told by people with clearances higher than he that we do, meaning you know, some portion of the American government, has recovered alien craft and alien bodies. We have been in possession of them for quite some time. Now, this kind of led me into wondering about the Apollo missions themselves. I mean, Edgar Mitchell, after all, was an Apollo astronaut. And I found a fellow that used to be a communication engineer for the Apollo missions. He was responsible for the radio headsets inside their spacesuits. And he overheard some of these guys talking about a briefing that they were put through, I think it was about a month before they were set to go up. And as it turns out, NASA would brief the astronauts, the Apollo astronauts anyway, about the UFO phenomenon, but they would wait till about 3 weeks before they would go up, simply because they did not want these guys to go up on this, you know, this multi-million dollar mission after having put millions into the hardware and putting millions into training them, only to have them to freak out and panic if something extraordinary happens, and jeopardize the mission, and also jeopardize this sort of ongoing subtle cover-up that NASA was maintaining at the time. And he was able to confirm that, and to me, that was a big revelation, because now that Buzz Aldrin has come out with his admission that there was UFOs following him on the way to the moon, this cast NASA at that time into a whole nother light. And I think we can safely say that they knew about it, they recorded it, and they even briefed their astronauts about this phenomenon, which was prudent. You know, after all, you don't want them going up and not telling them about this, because you don't, you know, you want them prepared. But the article that I this was all written up on is called "The UFOs and NASA, the Best Evidence." It was in the August 2005 edition of Fate magazine. And if people go to robsimone.com, they can read it for free. And it's also in my book, UFOs, Crop Circles, and the Mayan Calendar.
Speaking of NASA, David's been doing some research on Wernher von Braun and what he told his assistant, Carol Rosen,
yes,
about eventually the government having a hostile alien invasion threat scenario that they were planning.
Yep.
And you know, and again, speaking of NASA, do you think NASA's getting more involved in a military-type projects and the secrecy that goes along with it?
You know, I don't think so, because NASA is only involved in the missions that have actual people on them. The majority of work now is falling to JPL, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, which is located about 5 minutes drive from where I'm living right now, near Pasadena, California, right in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for that is, of course, that JPL handles all the unmanned missions. So they're the ones responsible for all the rovers, for all the probes that they sent out. And they're the ones that really are uncovering some incredible stuff. And I think they're the ones that are sitting on most of the information. NASA hasn't had a manned mission in years. You know, well, I mean, aside from the shuttle missions that go up and come down in low Earth orbit, they haven't, you know, they haven't explored things beyond, you know, beyond the upper atmosphere in quite a while. And that's one of the questions where everyone's asking, how come they haven't been back to the moon? You know, what was it there that was so uninteresting that they couldn't, you know, fund another mission in 20 years. So absolutely, I think it's mostly falling on JPL, and I even interviewed a guy who works for JPL. He's Dr. Albert Haldeman. He actually was in charge of the rover missions. And at the end of the interview, I got him to admit that he feels personally that life started on Mars, evolved there first, and worked its way over to Earth, which I think is an extraordinary mission from a PhD scientist at JPL who's, you know, head of the unmanned missions to Mars. It says a lot to what really goes on there, but few people, you know, have yet to discover.
I agree on that. We've only got, like, maybe 30 seconds left. Would you like to tell people where they can find your book?
My new book is UFOs in the Headlines. It's a coffee table book. It's pure journalism dealing with the UFO issue, and it's on Amazon. Just put in UFOs in the Headlines, or just put in Rob Simone, or they can just go to robsimone.com. There they can get all the information on the books, and even the link to a preview. You can read the first part of it for free.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
And thanks for being with me on my 10th show.
Thanks,
Steve. I enjoyed
it. Yeah.
And hope to have you on again.
Thanks so much.
And I've enjoyed this. And that's all the time we have for tonight, everybody. Thank you for being with us. And I want to thank everyone for tuning in and all those who joined us in the Pal Talk Auditorium. Stay tuned for Voice of the People, hosted by November Hansen. Tonight, her guest will be Robert Bradley. Join us again next Saturday on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network for another episode of Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis. Until then, keep an eye to the sky, and good night, everyone.